ago, this past Sunday, as was noted in last Sunday's service, we were one of the sites for the annual Nashua Holiday Stroll. And it really was. It was a wonderful occasion. We had 8 performances take place in this building. 4 were here in the sanctuary. The other 4 were up in the auditorium running from about 6 till 10 o'clock. What we had in here featured everything from gospel music by Pastor Ruth Choate of a local African-American congregation to a dance troupe called the Granite State Stompers to a gig featuring yo-yos and hula hoops. Quite an evening. Quite a range. I've got the whole program right here and lists all the venues and the events and a little map of where everything was going on. I'm sure a number of you were a part of that. 23 sites, which we were one of them, and about 70 events. Quite a range of churches took place. Everything from the every church from the Grace Fellowship to us. That's a pretty good spectrum right there. And a couple of banks, law offices, even Fody's Tavern over here on Clinton Street. It's quite a tribute, I think, to all who made it happen. I hope we can continue to be a part of this as the years go by, as both local establishments and religious communities take part in this thing. Well, what I didn't realize, though, about this whole event until I was recently alerted to it by the Reverend Jerry Falwell and Fox News commentator John Gibson and various others on the religious and political right, is that our holiday stroll right here in our fair city of Nashua is actually part of a liberal plot to get rid of Christmas. Bet you didn't know that. I mean, we had this gospel group here with Sister Ruth singing songs about the birth of Jesus. Go tell it on the mountain, Jesus Christ is born. Actually, I was coming across the back of the sanctuary. She was singing. I had to get up the auditorium for something. You know, timing is everything. John LaSalle and Gary LaRue are standing in the little passway there. Just as I hear Jesus Christ is born, the door opens and I keep walking. I keep walking through. Timing is everything, you know. Fine by me, by the way. It was a joyful expression of the faith tradition, the person doing the singing, which is what we should be doing at this time of year. But you see, the overall celebration on that Saturday evening was referred to as a holiday stroll and not a Christmas stroll, which is evidence enough for Mr.'s Gibson, Falwell, and others of their persuasion that something truly sinister is going on. So sinister, in fact, that John Gibson has seen fit to warn the populace at large by way of a book he's just written and published titled The War on Christmas, How the Liberal Plot to Ban the Sacred Christian Holiday is Worse Than You Thought. Well, it's worse than I thought. Full disclosure, I have not read this book in its entirety, but I've gleaned enough to get the general idea, which is that the use of phrases like Happy Holidays or Season's Greetings to a greater extent than the invoking of Merry Christmas is really a secular scheme with an anti-Christian agenda. Gibson's primary target is not so much government and this issue of whether or not creches or menorahs should be displayed on government property and that whole issue, so much as it is, his issue seems to be with merchants and business establishments who wish their customers happy holidays instead of Merry Christmas and who use more references to holidays than they do Christmases. Christmas. Never would have thought the word holiday would come to have such political significance, but I guess so. Indeed, Reverend Falwell's latest campaign is to undertake a boycott of stores that stick to happy holidays at this time of year instead of Merry Christmas. Well, I do not intend to devote a whole sermon to this topic, since there's only so far you can go with it. Whatever language a merchandising business chooses to use at this time of year, I assume hasn't got that much to do with politics and everything to do with a business decision made for business purposes, and my guess is they will go with whatever is pleasing to most of their customers. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, whatever it happens to be. And personally, it is of no great moment to me. If I make a purchase and a clerk wants to wish me a Merry Christmas or a Happy Holiday or anything else, I'm still going to hate shopping. And just want to get out of there and go home. And I will admit that trying to decide whether or not to call a decorated evergreen tree a Christmas tree or a holiday tree as the current mayor of Boston seems to be mulling over does strike me as rather frivolous, but neither term offends me much one way or the other. Folks will call it what they will, And it's certainly not going to lead to the elimination of Christmas or any of the other celebrations of this season. Indeed, here we are, a liberal religious congregation, and while we are not specifically or exclusively identified with the Christian faith, our most well-attended service every year, far and away, is our Christmas Eve service, held on the night of December 24th, when we probably violate every safe occupancy rule that the city of Nashua has on its books. And if we really wanted to ban Christmas, we'd keep our doors locked and our lights off on that evening. Come and celebrate Christmas Eve in a couple of weeks. I cannot let this matter go, though, without saying a little bit about what I see as being the greatest irony in this latest shot across the bow and the cultural wars that seem to continue to bedevil us. And here's what it is. It was really the first Christians to settle in this country, or in the New England, our New England part of this country, who actually did ban the celebration of Christmas for a certain time. Remember, they were Puritans. And the word Puritan meant they wanted to purify the Christian faith from any other influences other than Christianity, certainly including pagan ones. So, they reasoned. December the 25th is actually the date of a Roman pagan feast to the sun god Mithra, and was a celebration of the gradual return of the sun following the winter solstice, and the date bears no connection at all to the birth of Jesus. Besides, these Puritans had all kinds of suspicions of Catholicism anyway. They figured it was the Catholic Church that came up with December 25th date in the first place, and, you know, well, we know all about them. So, date for Christmas had to go, along with any festive celebrations on that date. And decorating trees and burning logs are really updated versions of the tree-hugging practices of the ancient Druids, about whom we already heard. So that's out the Christmas tree and the old log, as far as the Puritans were concerned. Greenery, too, was a pagan symbol for the persistence of life in the face of death, especially during the winter. So no hanging of the greens for our Puritan ancestors either, and so on, right on down the line. For a time, really, truly, in the mid-17th century, in Massachusetts, when the Puritans held their theocratic sway, the celebration of Christmas was legally banned, just as it was in England during the interregnum rule of Oliver Cromwell, for the very same reasons. I don't remember where I read this, and I couldn't go back, and I tried to look it up and couldn't find it, but I know I did read somewhere that the fine at one time for observing Christmas in New England at this time of year was something like about 5 or 6 shillings. It's always been a point of curiosity to me as to how that edict was enforced. I kind of wonder, you know, did the local authorities kind of go walking around up and down people's houses, you know, peeking in their windows, and if they saw somebody having a Christmas dinner or sort of having a festively good time, you know, did they break down the door and make arrests? I have no idea how they enforced all that, but it really did happen. Maybe not the breaking down the doors part, but the banning of Christmas. So as I say, the greatest irony in the Christian rights, the moaning of how the secularists and the liberals are trying to get rid of Christmas, is that the only people in this country who were ever actually managed to successfully do that were conservative Christians, our dear Puritan ancestors of nearly 4 centuries ago. And the compound irony is that those dear Puritan ancestors of ours were absolutely right in their reasons for banning Christmas. For many of the celebrations and decorations we associate with Christianity, with Christmas, have very little bearing at all upon the birth of Jesus, and they derive from celebrations, traditions, and customs that well predate the Christian era. When those Druids were decorating evergreens and dancing around those trees, I don't know what they called them, but I kind of doubt it was a Christmas tree. The celebration of Christmas at this time of year is really one of the later additions. The celebrations and festivities that have always happened at this time of year in our northern hemisphere. So our Puritan ancestors were right, but they're only right in a very narrow sense. They missed the bigger picture about the universality of this holiday season. And it is that bigger picture to which I'd now like to turn and take our leave of this notion that the only people standing between us and the elimination of Christmas are Jerry Falwell, John Gibson, and the vigilant staff at Fox News. The bigger picture is that the festivities and the celebrations and the observances of this season cannot be contained in any one religious tradition. They cannot, in fact, be contained at all, which is what our New England Puritan ancestors eventually came to learn. They cannot be contained because they speak to certain fundamental human needs and desires and yearnings that we all experience in the depths of our being, in our hearts and minds and souls, whether we identify with any one particular faith tradition or not. And I think that the four themes of the Christian Advent season, which begins on this Sunday, speak well to those universal yearnings. I find in them an example about how the particularities of one faith also transcend that faith and go up into the realm of the universal, and that's where I'd like to speak to them. For those themes are joy, hope, peace, and love. Once we get past what the late Abraham Maslow identified as our kind of a basic human survival needs, I'd say those four things speak to the next level of attributes that we need and that we have to have in order to give our lives a greater sense of wholeness and completion once our basic survival is attended to. Joy, hope, peace, and love. Those aren't the same terms that Maslow used, but they jive well with his well-known hierarchy of needs. I'm just going to touch those bases very briefly for the next few moments. Start with joy. Joy is not the same thing as having fun, or being amused or entertained, or in somehow being diverted for a time from some of the more ponderous matters of our lives. Joy may come to include all of those things. And I personally like fun and amusement and diversions. I find a certain joy in all of them. But joy in living is really about appreciating the life you have and the world in which you have to live, even with all those times that life and that world have let you down or wounded or hurt you deeply. It's how you come back to life and how you find a way of still appreciating the life that you have. That's what it is to live in joy. And then there's hope. Hope is not quite the same thing as optimism. It's not believing that everything is always going to turn out okay, because we know it's not. Not always, anyway. Here again, I am basically an optimist. I seek to look for happy outcomes to whatever situations I'm in that I may come up against. But hope is bigger than that. To live with hope is to believe that we human beings, if we live with conviction and compassion, can still affect positive change, whether we see the full fruits of our efforts come to bear in our lifetime or not. Living in hope is about holding on to a basic bedrock assumption or affirmation that the future remains open, that the past does not have to fully define the future, that life is still there for the choosing, at whatever point in your life journey you may be. Hope is believing that life continues to be worth the journey with all of its knowns and unknowns, and however bleak it may be at any one time. In fact, the best expression of hope that I've found, I know I've referred to it before, comes from the writings of one of the 20th century's best-known atheists and humanists, Albert Camus, who in his own way was also a pretty religious guy. Camus once said, "In the midst of winter, I discovered that there was within me an invincible spring." That line is part of my personal sacred scripture. To live in hope is to tend to and to nurture your invincible spring, the spring that you carry around somewhere within you. It is to hold on to and believe in that spring through whatever winters of the spirit you may have to weather. There's peace. Peace, of course, is more than the absence of war or conflict. Although conditions being what they are right now, I think I'd settle for that, at least as a starting point. But peace, as numerous others have observed, as I just say, is more than the absence or more than the absence of war. It is the presence of what we in our Unitarian Universalist principles call justice, equity, and compassion. If there is ever to be such a thing as peace on earth, it will come about. When all the peoples of this earth feel that they have some reasonable stake in and some share of its bounty and resources, it is when we somehow realize that there is indeed enough to go around, if we will but seek ways to make it happen. None of us are going to make that happen in our lifetimes, I'm afraid. But reflecting on what I just said about hope, we need to believe that the investment of some part of our lives, here and now, is a worthy contribution to that greater goal of peace on earth. I hope we can renew that commitment to ourselves in the days and weeks ahead. And finally, there's love. Romantic love, love of a sentimental nature, are all well and good, wonderful, delightful. I don't dismiss or belittle anything like that. Being something also of a romantic myself, I can even handle Barry Manilow in certain measured doses. Measured doses. But the love I want to point to here, briefly touching now this fourth base of Advent, is about feeling a deep sense of identification and connection to and with this larger life that surges all around us. And caring deeply and caring passionately about that life, it is this kind of love that lets us know that we do not live for ourselves alone, but that we are part of a larger life that needs our energy and our efforts and our human goodwill. Whether it is love for another person, for a family, a community, the world at large. What it means is that your life is also part of that other life or lives. And the what goes on in those other lives is also happening, going on with you. That's what I mean by a sense of identification and connection. And the Christian legend of the Incarnation, which holds that God chose to embody the full meaning of love by appearing on earth as a human being, that's what it is. And one need not, I feel, be a part of that faith in order to appreciate its message. The message is that we too, in our lives, need to be incarnations of love in the truest and deepest sense. So I try to use these four themes or attributes as a way of celebrating the universality and the holiness of this season and to make of it as a true holiday. As most of you, I'm sure, know, the very word holiday is really a contracted form of two words, holy day. So to wish someone a happy holiday or a happy holy day is hardly a denigration of any of the particular celebrations of this blessed season. It is instead a recognition that no one observance and no one single faith tradition can contain the many expressions of joy, hope, peace, and love that this season evokes. For this is a holiday and a holy time for all persons who seek these things, both in their personal lives and in the world in which those lives are lived. This is a holiday and a holy time for all persons of faith. Persons of faith in the largest sense of that phrase. Faith that the blessings of life are stronger than death itself. Faith that life and our lives can be renewed, even as the earth and time will renew itself. Faith that persons of goodwill who walk on a myriad of religious and spiritual paths can also walk together on the common ground of a human community. So celebrate this season in all the ways that are meaningful to you. Speak to it in whatever ways and with whatever language best conveys the stirrings of your own heart. I continue to appreciate much of the language and the symbols and the images of Christmas, largely because it is a part of my personal heritage, even if I no longer fully embrace the faith in which it comes. I'll have more to say about that in a couple of weeks. So as a human community, and as a liberal religious community, we should rightfully celebrate the presence of joy, hope, and peace and love in our midst, and seek to extend the blessings of each and all of these things in whatever ways are available to us. And in so doing, we will honor the many meanings of the blessed and holy days that are ahead of us. Let's sing together hymn number 57, All Beautiful, the marching piece.